58 that Mark set in 1991. The sun will set this evening at 4:17. Right now, mostly sunny skies and 19 degrees. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. Support for The Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Also, the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.
I'm not sure that there is a book before the American public that has been as widely discussed as the book titled The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. And as you can gather by the beginning of the title, their assessment is an ominous one. It is the belief of these 27 professional health professionals that President Donald Trump is dangerous for our country, and that his dangerousness stems at least in part by what may be certain personality disorders or even types of mental illness. This is a conclusion not drawn lightly or in haste. The editor of this book is Dr. Bandy X. Lee, who is assistant clinical professor in law and psychiatry at Yale School of Medicine. She has done a great deal of work in various arenas, and among other things, has been very, very instrumental in the prevention of violence for the World Health Organization. She has written more than 100 peer-reviewed articles and is the author of a previous textbook, which is titled Violence. Again, she serves as editor of this brand new book from St. Martin's Press called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. Dr. Lee, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Part of what can help us understand this book is to help us understand an event which you helped to create and chair at Yale University. Explain when this special event occurred and what prompted you to call it into session.
Yes. First of all, please let me clarify that I'm speaking on my own behalf and not representing the views of my institutions, Yale University, Yale School of Medicine, or Yale Department of Psychiatry. Although my university has been very supportive of free debate and, in fact, sponsored all the provisions for the conference, did not co-organize it because of the political nature or the imputed politicization that was at risk at the time. But the reason why I came to organize the conference was because there was a deafening silence around professionals of my field. I was very concerned since the since the election, really. But I wasn't particularly thinking it was my domain until the morning after election, when I was just flooded with phone calls and emails from previous civil society organizations, patient advocacy groups, members of state government, lawyers, students, activists, documentary filmmakers. They were all getting in touch with me because I am an expert on violence, and they were afraid of the violence that was to come. And so I suddenly realized that that this had something to do with my professional domain as well. I asked around my colleagues, or actually initially I got in touch with an old colleague, Dr. Judith Herman, who had written a letter to President Obama asking him to require a neuropsychiatric evaluation of the president-elect at the time. Of course, nothing happened, but the letter got publicized. And so I contacted her and thought I would write letters of my own to Congress members and circulated the letter. Everyone agreed with me in terms of their assessment of the president and their concern, but no one would put their name on the letter. And so I thought that was not good and that silence wasn't the answer. And so so I decided to hold an ethics conference simply to discuss the ethical guideline not to diagnose a public figure without having personally examined them and gotten consent from them versus the duty to warn when there is a danger to others or the public. In general, we have a duty to report, to warn, and to even take steps to protect when others are in danger or the public is in danger. And so just this raising this ethical question alone still got a lot of controversy. And so when I held the event, it was in an auditorium of 500 seats. Only 20 showed up. But over 100 people tuned in online. And subsequently, as the event got known actually around the country and around the world, hundreds and hundreds of mental health professionals were getting in touch with me, now in the thousands. They were all concerned. The assessment was almost universal. There was a consensus among all of us that this was a very serious situation. And so the book came out of just a select group from those mental health professionals. The speakers at the conference, Robert J. Lifton, Judith Herman, James Gilligan, all contributed to it, and as well as a number of proposals that have also flooded in a way that I could not include them all. But that's how the conference seemed to tap into a groundswell of a movement that I did not know existed, and everyone else didn't know about each other, felt they were all alone, but this event got us together.
Hmm. And again, it's thought of as this conference around the notion of duty to warn and mm-hmm. and a petition. I don't believe circulated by you, circulated by someone else in the field, has, mm-hmm. has garnered more than 60,000 signatures from mental health professionals. So mm-hmm. your book, in a sense, is, one could say, maybe kind of the tip of the iceberg in terms of the collective concern of this particular group.
Yes, that is right.
Your book is split into three different sections, and I actually want to talk about the second section before we talk about the first and the third.
Mm-hmm.
But the three sections are the Trump phenomenon, in which a number of different mental health professionals weigh in with their own assessments of what might be going on inside the head of President Donald Trump, and certain assessments made, if not official diagnoses. And
it's a differential diagnosis, I should make clear. So it's almost an exhaustive list of all the major conditions that would be useful for the public to know about regarding this situation.
Right, and we'll get into some of that in just a little bit. And the third section of the book, called The Trump Effect, talks about some of the ways in which the American public as a whole are being mentally and emotionally affected by our president. But the second section is, I think, very important for us to talk about first. And in many respects, this was the heart and soul of the conference that you convened at Yale mm-hmm. University earlier in the year. One of the concerns that is addressed here goes back to something called the Goldwater Rule, which came into force in 1964 during that presidential campaign, ultimately won by Lyndon Johnson over Barry Goldwater. First of all, sketch for us what occurred back in 1964 that ultimately led to the creation of what is now known as the Goldwater Rule.
Yes, I believe you've outlined the context pretty well. It was during the presidential campaign of Barry Goldwater against Lyndon Johnson that a magazine called Fact put out a survey to over 12,000 psychiatrists. Less than 10% responded, saying that Barry Goldwater was unfit to be president because of various wild conjectures, because none of them had really nearly enough information to make any diagnoses. But that resulted in a landslide win by Lyndon Johnson. The magazine sensationalized it, of course, saying that 1,100 psychiatrists are saying Barry Goldwater is unfit to serve, whereas it was such a small minority of psychiatrists who were claiming that. But in any case, it was enough of an outpour to have thought to have been contributory to his great loss, and he later sued the magazine and won. So at that time, based on these events, when the American Psychiatric Association was redrafting its ethical guidelines, they put in a sentence stating that if asked about a public figure, do not diagnose, but you are encouraged to educate the public regarding relevant psychiatric issues in general terms. So there are actually two parts to the Goldwater Rule. One is do not diagnose. The other part is educate. And so we have kept with the Goldwater Rule, believe it or not, in terms of not diagnosing, but educating the public. And that's why you see all the potential possibilities without weighing in one way or on one diagnosis or another above others.
In response to the inevitable concerns and criticisms from some who would say that, or might assume even without reading a book like yours, that your book is in violation of the Goldwater Rule to some extent, one of the points raised, and I don't remember if it's raised by you or one of your contributors, is another notion that apparently springs from a court decision in 1976 known as the Tarasoff decision.
Mm-hmm.
Explain what this decision was about and sort of the light that it sheds on your project and the legitimacy of a book like this.
Yes, so when we do mention Mr. Trump in particular, We are relying on the ethical guidelines given by the Tarasoff ruling. So that was a ruling in California where a patient was seen by a counselor. He described feelings of wanting to kill his ex-girlfriend, and the counselor basically kept confidentiality and did not do anything. He proceeded to go ahead and did murder her. And after that, the court ruled that not only did the counselor have a duty to warn potential victims, because in a case of an emergency, confidentiality and consent no longer hold up. Those are our sacrosanct rules, but still, an emergency is urgent enough that you should break them in order to take the steps necessary to protect life and well-being. And then they did a second ruling that not only do you have a duty to warn, you also have a duty to protect. So it's not enough just to warn the potential victim, but you have to take steps to ensure enough action to be able to protect the person. And so people often do not realize that mental health professionals are constantly engaged in risk assessment. Every time they have a clinical encounter, every time they see a patient, they are screening for danger to self, others, or the public. And they are legally obligated, legally authorized, if not obligated, to protect the safety and well-being of potential victims. We collaborate with the police, with ambulances, the hospital, in order to carry out these duties. So the Tarasoff ruling, although it was in California, it has been adopted in most states and has been expanded over time. So there have been hundreds of additional court rulings adding to the Tarasoff requirement. So before it was, if the patient tells you, you should take steps to protect. Now it's no longer even if the patient tells you. If you learn from anybody that someone is a danger, then you have a duty to warn. So although the Tarasoff ruling is just for pre-existing patient relationships, one can put it more generally based on medical guidelines that if someone is a danger, if there is an emergency, you actually no longer have the choice as to whom to take as a patient. You have to treat the person. So we're generalizing a little bit based on the principles of medical ethics, because there is no Tarasoff equivalent for the Goldwater rule. But in terms of general medical ethics, our responsibility for safety, the health and safety of not only patients, but the public, we have a responsibility to the public as well, could be extrapolated here.
Hmm. And so we have in this section of the book several different essays that sort of grapple with this question of the appropriateness of mental health professionals weighing in with the kind of assessments that are shared in your book. One of those essays is from Dr. Leonard L. Glass, who confronts this, I think, very, very frankly. And one of the things that actually sort of surprised me, given the fact that he holds one opinion very firmly, is that he acknowledges the other possibility, the other possible answer, which, unlike his answer to the question, which is, yes, we can and should speak out in this way, he acknowledges that one can legitimately believe otherwise, that there it is possible to have a difference of opinion on this, and that both of those opinions are fully defensible. And I suspect that you appreciate the fact that he is as even-handed as he is in presenting this central question.
Yes, I appreciate the complexity he brings to ethical questions, because ethics are not laws. They require us to bring our agency and to weigh different decisions to each problem. Ethical questions are never singular. There are usually rules and countervailing rules, and the Goldwater Rule itself is rather complex. It has not been debated nearly enough. It's based on one court ruling, you know, more than 50 years ago, as you've noted. And, you know, unlike the Tarasoff Rule, which has been in courts, you know, hundreds of times and affirmed, if not expanded, the Goldwater Rule really has been stagnant all these years. And the American Psychiatric Association has actually been interpreting it more and more permissively. In fact, a few years before Mr. Trump's campaign, they were considering making it just an etiquette, or even abolishing the rule altogether. But the strange thing that has happened is, since his inauguration, barely 2 months into his presidency, the American Psychiatric Association turned the Goldwater Rule into something else, making an interpretation that defies any of its earlier interpretations, doesn't really make sense, even from the point of view where it is currently written. And so there has been a lot of debate since that has happened, and actually they've been flooded with letters and protests and resignations, and Dr. Glass is one of the lifelong members, honorary members, who has resigned from the American Psychiatric Association. Over this issue, yes.
One thing he says in his essay that I find quite interesting, when he is beginning to present his own opinion, his own answer to this question of whether or not these kind of assessments are appropriate, he writes this: "The Goldwater Rule, especially in its expanded interpretation, makes an error in categorizing. It conflates a professional opinion, a clinical assessment that is the basis for the care of a patient, with the opinion of a professional commenting in a non-clinical role, for instance, as a mental health expert offering his perspective in the public square. There is no patient in the latter instance, and hence the standards for providing only a clinically derived assessment with the patient's authorization and with due regard for the patient's confidentiality are not applicable." Again, here there is no patient. I hadn't stopped to think about that very obvious point, but as one is considering this, that's an important matter to remember.
Yes, yes. And there are lawyers who are interested in arguing against the current interpretation of the Goldwater Rule based on First Amendment rights, because without a patient and without an established professional relationship, there should not be restriction on our First Amendment rights. States, for example, are not allowed to adopt the Goldwater Rule into their licensing standards. But I think there was someone who did an extensive search and learned that a few actually do. So those are other governments that are in violation of other governmental bodies that are in violation of the First Amendment. I myself am a proponent of the rule, partly because as a forensic psychiatrist, I am often doing evaluations where the court or lawyers ask me to diagnose someone without having evaluated them. And even defendants in court are considered minor public figures under certain circumstances, and And I've always refused to diagnose because a definitive diagnosis requires really all the information, not just an in-person examination where you might discover things that would not be apparent in other settings and you need to follow through, but you can't ask about pertinent negatives, you don't have their medical records or know about any other conditions that can explain their presentation. And so I personally do believe that it is it's just a responsible thing to do to diagnose only when you have all the information, and then the person becomes your patient, so you should do it on consent. But here, we are not diagnosing, but we are assessing dangerousness. That is different because it is not about the person, it is about the situation. To assess dangerousness, you do not need all the information. You only need enough information to raise alarms that you suspect danger. And then the next step is that you contain the person, remove the person from access to weapons, and do an urgent evaluation. With that evaluation, you may get a diagnosis then. But until then, you're simply alerting the need for an evaluation.
We're speaking with Dr. Brandi X. Lee, who is the editor of a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. 27 psychiatrists and mental health experts assess a president. We're about to move into the first section of the book called The Trump Phenomenon, in which a number of different essays are presented and some possibilities are outlined that we'll get into in just a moment. Dr. Lee, I'm interested to ask you, what kind of professional risk did it involve for you and for your colleagues and counterparts, for that matter, to speak out in this way? And did you do so with any trepidation in terms of what the professional consequences might possibly be?
Yes, when no one was speaking out, others would tell me that they did not wish to come forth because well, not so much because of the ethical rules, but because they were afraid of being targeted, targeted by a litigious president who often used lawsuits to vindicate against other people, or his violence-prone followers, that they did not wish to spend their lives worried for their families, or worried they might lose their license, or fighting for their licenses, that was not the way they wished to spend the rest of their lives. For me, that actually pointed to the magnitude of the danger. So if in this case, warning about the danger meant being subject to that very danger, then it was all the more imperative that we warn about this danger. We intervene in all circumstances where danger is suspected. In fact, states have expanded their laws and requirements for us to intervene and err on the side of error than to let suspicions go. And while I'm asked to intervene in every other circumstance, I did not see the reason for withholding in a situation where this could mean a risk to human life as we know it. The power of the presidency goes far beyond any individual that I have treated, and I, being an expert on violence, violent individuals are my patient base, and so it was very clear to me, and I suppose it was really those phone calls from civil society members early on that gave me a sense that I needed to specifically act on this, even if my colleagues were not yet decided or they did not feel they had enough information to judge dangerousness or for other reasons did not feel it was their duty. I felt that it was my duty, especially since I'm very familiar with this patient population.
What about the matter of political bias and objection to policy? And I wonder how much you grappled with this, particularly in your role as editor of this book, in the gathering of these essays and deciding whose voices would be heard. And I guess what prompts the question is the fact that somebody might assess President Donald Trump and feel a certain sympathy or certain appreciation for many, most, maybe all of his policy positions, and yet be assessing this matter of dangerousness on its own, while someone else might come to that very same task as someone who already has all kinds of political objections to what President Donald Trump stands for, his aims, his goals in office. It seems to me that's a very, very complicated situation. For you and for your contributors, how did you wrestle with that in terms of making this about the man and his mental and emotional state versus being about the specific policies he wishes to enact, policies with which you might strenuously object or wholeheartedly favor?
Well, that's very easy for me to do. As a forensic psychiatrist, I'm called to be an expert for multiple criminal cases and civil cases, and if there were any bias brought into it, if I brought bias to any situation, then that would quickly affect my reputation. So to be scrupulous about my medical neutrality and scientific objectivity, that's what we're trained to do. And as health professionals, we abide by a health model, which has, almost completely to do with health versus illness, life versus death, not ideology such as liberal versus conservative, Democrat versus Republican. That actually does not even enter into the equation if we are being professional and acting as experts. Usually what we do in both clinical situations or legal situations is that we examine ourselves. There's a process called autognosis, knowing oneself, that if your biases are potentially going to affect a therapeutic situation or a legal situation, then you recuse yourself. That's a regular practice one does as a forensic mental health professional, but also as a clinician, because the goal is to help the patient become better, make their own decisions, and better be able to make their choices, whether it's taking a liberal side or conservative side. It's the ability to make choices that one helps to foster in terms of restoring health. It's when emotional needs or compulsions or lack of control affects the ability to make those choices, then we work on removing those interferences. Mm. Now, personally, I had not been politically active at all before this, or even partisan. I was simply not that interested. I not registered with either party. I've worked for public good and worked for public mental health and public health, but I never really thought of myself in partisan terms. So for me, it was very easy not to do this as a Democrat or Republican. But most of all, in terms of selecting authors, so many were reluctant to come forth that the error was more on the other side. What was preventing them from, so in order for them to come forth and warn about danger, the danger must be pretty pretty extreme, and to have this many people come forth. And also among those who contacted me, there were many independents, even Republicans, with the same opinion. It is a medical consensus, not a partisan consensus. Yeah.
When we get into the first part of the book, the Trump phenomenon, in which some of these issues related to mental illness and personality disorders and so on are explored, there are a lot of things we see there that, that most of us, at least to some extent, understand, although your book really helps clarify what we're exactly talking about with something like, for instance, narcissism. I have to confess that I actually did not know the term. I'd seen it before, but did not really know what hedonism is, H-E-D-O-N-I-S-M. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the first condition that is explored. And I found this especially fascinating, as I say, in part because this is something I'd never really read anything about before. Explain what hedonism is and the deep concerns that these co-authors have regarding our president.
Yes, as you know, the authors of that chapter, especially Dr. Phil Zimbardo, is the renowned psychologist known for his Stanford prison experiment. And he and Rosemary Sword have been writing about this concept for quite some time, far before Mr. Trump. And it has mostly to do with the inability to think of mostly future consequences. So inability to think about time, really, that you're purely living in the present and purely going after whatever gives you pleasure or relief. And they felt that that was the first characteristic that that was of significance in terms of Mr. Trump's presentation. And we see that in his impulsivity, the need to do whatever it takes to help himself feel better. Usually it is about relieving feelings of smallness, worthlessness, his insecurities, his patterns of reactions, his need to burnish a sense of power, his splitting the world into winners and losers and having to win all the time in the extreme, all indicate a very severe emotional need that needs to be quenched every moment. And so that preoccupation does not free him to be able to think of the future and of consequences. Hmm.
As we're talking about this specific instance, one of the things that these authors do in order to, in a sense, prove their case or demonstrate their case is that they provide an array of quotes of President Clinton, things that he has said, and in some cases things that he has done that would seem to indicate this case of extreme hedonism. The question is, particularly when somebody operates in the public sphere, how does one discern the difference between what someone is really doing sort of as their own authentic self versus what somebody is doing as though they were on a stage and in a sense performing, and in particular in the case of President Trump perhaps speaking and acting in ways that resonate deeply with his base, with his most fervent followers. When one is assessing the mental and emotional state of someone, isn't it a particularly stiff challenge when one is talking about a public figure, like, for instance, the President of the United States?
Yes, you're exactly right. And one of the reasons why we do not base our assessment or full diagnosis on a public presentation is because the person could be putting on an act. And we cannot employ some of the tests that we would be able to in person with a person when they are at a distance. With President Trump, we have far more information than we even ordinarily have with patients. That is, we have a lot of documented evidence of his immediate responses to situations in real time over lots of time. I mean, scores and scores of information in ways we seldom have of any public figure. And so the pattern would suggest that it is not his acting or acting out of a brilliant strategy, but rather being unable to help himself. And oftentimes that is difficult to distinguish. That is exactly when mental health professionals can be of help, because one thing they can do is distinguish disease from health, especially with mental disorder. Mm-hmm. When one becomes mentally ill, one of the things that one loses most of the time is what is called insight, the ability to recognize that something is wrong. And the further one descends into illness, the more likely they are to insist that the choices they're making are theirs and not the illness. They're more likely to make destructive choices. They're more likely to insist that others are sick and not them, that there's nothing wrong with them, and they're bound to run as far as possible from any kind of treatment or evaluation. And that is exactly why the law and courts allow mental health professionals and physicians to do evaluations against people's will, because it's precisely when they truly need it urgently that they lose the insight and ability to cooperate.
Hmm. The chapter on narcissism is quite interesting. The title of it is Pathological Narcissism and Politics, which touches on two matters explored in this chapter. One of them being that that we often think of narcissists in the political arena, that the typical politician probably is a narcissist to some extent, or else they would not thrust themselves into such an arena. But also in this chapter that there is the matter of a spectrum of narcissism, and it's important for us to think about narcissism as not as an either-or state, you are one or you are not. We probably all are, as human beings, narcissists, maybe to some extent, but that there is a point when this narcissism becomes truly counterproductive, and it is the contention, at least of Dr. Craig Malkin, that that's what we are talking about with President Trump.
Yes, you're exactly right. Narcissism, there's healthy narcissism and there's pathological narcissism, and there are different degrees of pathological narcissism where it may, you know, just begin to affect your relationships or annoy other people. But in a severe state, your function can be compromised. You may not be able to think correctly. And in extreme situations, you may not even be able to distinguish fantasy from reality, or become very enraged that you cannot think straight or withhold your impulses. And So in terms of danger, extreme pathological narcissism would be one of the risk factors, one of the greatest risk factors for violence and danger.
There is also the matter explored in this chapter of his impulsivity and of his lack of trust of others. And what would be the most significant ways in which this is perhaps a very critical matter?
Well, lack of trust comes from paranoia, actually perceiving threat where it doesn't exist. And for an individual showing signs of pathological narcissism, then paranoia ends up being the inevitable result, because your needs are basically to be able to fill yourself with what you do not have, which is self-love. And so so you will expect others to constantly adore you, constantly approve of you, and inevitably reality will never meet your expectations and people will never meet your expectations. And so one is usually very charming with others when they expect that they will be able to meet their needs, but once they realize that reality, the real relationships, never fulfill their needs, they become paranoid of others. They tend to isolate themselves. They think everyone is after them, so they may actually feel they need to hit first before they give the others a chance to hit them.
As these essays came into you, did you find yourself tempted to temper their language? I'm asking that because, at least for the most part, this feels like very unbridled writing. That is, at least some of these essays are not written in a particularly dispassionate way, but obviously spring from a place of burning concern. But probably an argument could be raised that that were the language always a little cooler, there's the possibility that that some of these points raised might be even more persuasive for those who are skeptical. I suspect, though, that as editor, you really did not want to do that, that you wanted these writers to speak as frankly as they do. I wonder if you just wrestled with that at all.
We did think of that. We did think of the segment of the population that would not be convinced, but we were not writing with a strategy in mind. We wanted to write the way things were. And if you actually look at any of the assertions, they are all data-driven. In other words, they're backed by evidence. They're based on scientific research. We do not make claims where nothing exists. This collection, although in a trade book, we really treated it as a peer-reviewed collection of our expertise. We tried to meet every standard it could meet for any peer-reviewed journal. The language is simplified, of course, so as to be understandable, but the rest would stand up to any scientific test. I also removed any financial conflict of interest. None of the royalties will go to any of the authors. It's going into a fund first to protect the authors because they were taking such risks, so legal or medical bills. But the rest is going into improving public mental health.
Well, we leave it to our listeners to explore this remarkable book for themselves. The book, again, is titled The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. The book is edited by Dr. Vandy X. Lee. Dr. Lee, I thank you so much for making time in your schedule to talk about this important book. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have reached out to the American Psychiatrist Association, an organization that officially has taken exception to this book.